Well, today I will take up from volume 16, SABCL 16, a chapter called Rebirth. As I told you earlier, there are three or four chapters here which relate directly with rebirth, the soul, evolution, heredity, etc. But I don't think we'll have time enough to go through all these chapters. I'm planning to go through the first chapter, Rebirth, in the remaining time that is available to us in this month. So those of you who have this volume 16, if you could bring it, it would be good. I start reading from the chapter, Rebirth. The theory of rebirth is almost as ancient as thought itself, and its origin is unknown. We may, according to our prepossessions, accept it as the fruit of ancient psychological experience, always renewable and verifiable, and therefore true, or dismiss it as a philosophical dogma and ingenious speculation. But in either case, the doctrine, even as it is in all appearance well nigh as old as human thought itself, is likely also to endure as long as human beings continue to think. You can see a fine opening telling us about this theory of rebirth, that it is as ancient as human thought and it will endure as long as human beings continue to think. So it only points to that it is one of the eternal truths of our existence, and no philosophy or psychology or science can deny it, whatever may be the problems in proving it. In former times, the doctrine used to pass in Europe under the grotesque name of transmigration, which brought with it to the Western mind the humorous image of the soul of Pythagoras migrating, a haphazard bird of passage, from the human form divine into the body of a guinea pig or an ass. The philosophical appreciation of the theory expressed itself in the admirable but rather unmanageable Greek word metempsychosis, which means the insouling of a new body by the same psychic individual. Now this question of the, he's going to the word itself, the origin of this word rebirth. You see, first it was thought the word transmigration would be all right, but that was a bit too gross in the sense that, you know, it is as if the soul is passing from one body into another immediately after it leaves one body. So Shrivabindu is telling us that is not suitable. And then the Greek word metempsychosis, as it says himself, that it is a bit of a difficult word, unmanageable, he says. But the word by itself catches the true meaning, you see, which means insouling of a new body by the same psychic individual. So this is in essence the truth of rebirth, that the same psychic being gets into different bodies. So basically the word is good, it catches the essence of the meaning, but it's too unmanageable a word in English. So he would say, the other option was reincarnation. Reincarnation is the now popular term, but the idea in the word leans to the gross or external view of the fact and begs many questions. You can imagine the word reincarnation immediately gives us an idea that maybe the same person who has reincarnated. So reincarnation has this problem of Mr. X has become Mr. Y, but the same Mr. X with a new body. That means the outer personality. You see, reincarnation gives the idea of the rebirth of the outer personality. In fact, if you remember in the Life Divine, he told us about some Mr. Phillips, if he is reborn as Mr. Smith, then it is the outer personality that is repeated. So the word reincarnation also is not a preferable one. So he says, I prefer rebirth. For it renders a sense of the wide, colorless, but sufficient Sanskrit term punarjanma, again birth, and commits us to nothing but the fundamental idea, which is the essence and life of the doctrine. So ultimately he is telling us why he chooses the word rebirth, because it is closest to Sanskrit, not because it's closest to Sanskrit, but because it really gives us a very wide, colorless, and at the same time the essence of the meaning. It is punarjanma or rebirth, is again birth. Whose birth? The psychic being. So it is the birth again of the psychic being. So this is the clarification regarding the name rebirth. Now, rebirth is for the modern mind no more than a speculation and a theory. It has never been proved by the methods of modern science or to the satisfaction of the new critical mind formed by a scientific culture. Neither has it been disproved, for modern science knows nothing about a before life or an afterlife for the human soul, knows nothing indeed about a soul at all, nor can know. Its province stops with the flesh and brain and nerve, the embryo and its formation and development. Obviously, science cannot tell us anything about rebirth. Because in fact, the limitation of science is between birth and rebirth. That means with a single body. So it doesn't know what was there in this body before or what would be there when this body is left after life. So it's a question of embryo, information, etc. of this very body. So it cannot help us in any way. Neither has modern criticism any apparatus by which the truth or untruth of rebirth can be established. In fact, modern criticism, with all its pretensions to searching investigation and scrupulous certainty, is no very efficient truth finder. So you see, the modern science, I mean, with all its claim that it is really an objective science, it will look into the whole thing and give us truth. He says no. In spite of all its investigation, it has got even searching, I mean, it's got so many tools now. You got it, psychotherapy, psychology, psychoanalysis, and you know, there's endless things are coming up for finding about the truth. But Sri Aurobindo says, it is not a very efficient truth finder. Outside the sphere of the immediate physical, it's almost helpless. Wonderful thing. So the science is good, or at its best, if I can put it, only related to things that are physical. Beyond the physical, it is helpless. It is good at discovering data, but except where the data themselves bear on the surface their own conclusion, it has no means of being rightly sure of the generalization it announces from them, so confidently in one generation and destroys in the next. But I think we have seen this many a time, how it announces some kind of a generalization. They say, this is the truth. We should have this kind of a food, and then in the next generation it changes all its philosophy and policies and says, this kind of a food is not right. You know, science itself has never been stable. Obviously science will say, because we are discovering every year, every generation, new truths. So it says, it keeps changing. So it has no means of finding out with surety the truth or untruth of a doubtful historical assertion. After a century of dispute, it has not even been able to tell us yes or no whether Jesus Christ ever existed. How then shall it deal with such a matter as this of rebirth, which is stuff of psychology and must be settled rather by psychological than physical evidence? So this question of rebirth had nothing to do with modern science or modern criticism, but as you can see, it has, it cannot be stable or really find out the inner truth. The nearest that can come to the truth of rebirth is a study of psychology, which can really tell us something, not sciences, any other science. The arguments which are usually put forward by supporters and opponents are often sufficiently futile and at their best certainly insufficient either to prove or to disprove anything in the world. One argument, for instance, often put forward triumphantly in disproof is this, that we have no memory of our past lives and therefore there were no past lives. But remember, we had the same argument in the Life Divine, because people would tell us normally, how do you know there's a rebirth, that you are reborn? Do you remember your past lives? And if you remember the argument that Sri Aurobindo had given in the Life Divine, he says, how much of your own childhood do you remember? Hardly anything. When you are 3 years old, 5 years old, what did you do? Do you remember that? So it doesn't mean you didn't have a childhood. So he said, this is a fallacious argument to say, because we don't remember our past lives, it never existed. And if you remember, the second argument he had given was, in fact, it is necessary for the development of this life that consciously the past memories are erased from your mind, and even the psychic being doesn't bring it forward, because it is redundant. In fact, sometimes it could be harmful to remember who I was in a past life, because it can obstruct psychologically the present flowering of your personality. So these are some of the arguments. Now you'll see what it gives us here. So I think one or two is going to repeat. One smiles to see such reasoning seriously used by those who imagine that they are something more than intellectual children. The argument proceeds on psychological grounds, and yet it ignores the very nature of our ordinary or physical memory, which is all that the normal man can employ. How much do we remember of our actual lives, which we are undoubtedly living at the present moment? The first argument is the same thing. How much do we remember of our own life now? Our memory is normally good, for what is near becomes vaguer or less comprehensive as its objects recede into the distance. Farther off seizes only some salient points, and finally, for the beginning of our lives, falls into a mere blankness. Do we remember even the mere fact, the simple state of being an infant on the mother's breast? And yet that state of infancy was, on any but a Buddhist theory, part of the same life and belonged to the same individual, and the very one who cannot remember it just as he cannot remember his past life. In the same argument, that we don't remember our childhood, we don't remember what we did and how, what we talked, nothing. But you see something in between, he says, on any but a Buddhist theory. So what is the difference between Buddhist theory and this theory? Because in a normal theory of rebirth, we are the same person since the time we were born, but we don't remember necessarily. But a Buddhist would say, we are not the same person since we were born. Because as we say, the question of momentariness, or what they call the kshanikavada, that we are like a flux, our life is like a flux changing every second, every moment we change. So that's why he says, Buddhists would say, no, at the age of 5 what I was, I'm completely different now, I'm not the same person. So I can deny my past because I'm not the same person. Even what I was at 6 o'clock, I'm not now the same person. So for a Buddhist, this theory of memory doesn't last, because they don't have anything called a memory. So he would say, at the most, there is a semblance. If people say, how do you know that? Because I do remember what I did last year at this time, month of June. So there is only a semblance of memory. You have put together some incidents and make it into a kind of a semblance of memory, but actually is not right. That's what we call the word delusion. You think you are the same person, it's a delusion. So that is why Sri Aurobindo puts immediately says, except for the Buddhist theory, this holds true that we don't remember anything of our childhood. Yet we demand that this physical memory, this memory of the brute brain of man, which cannot remember our infancy and has lost so much of our later years, shall yet recall that which was before infancy, before birth, before itself was born? A very simple argument. But you see the same argument. How do you expect us to remember something that was there even before our birth when we don't remember maybe what happened a few years back? And sometimes we don't even remember what we did in the morning. So this kind of a lapse of memory is so evident in our lives. So how do we expect us to remember something that was formed before our birth? And if it cannot, we are to cry, disproved your reincarnation theory. So what a blazing announcement. So there's nothing called reincarnation because you can't remember it. The sapient incipiency of our ordinary human reasoning could go no farther than in this sort of ratiocination. Obviously, if our past lives are to be remembered, whether as fact and state or in their events and images, it can only be by a psychical memory, awakening which will overcome the limits of the physical and resuscitate impressions other than those stamped on the physical being by physical cerebration. Even this we were told in the Life Divine, that the only memory that we could have is a psychical memory. Actually, there is no other memory of past lives apart from the psychical memory. Well, there have been instances, as you know, of people remembering, you know, the children who say, yes, I remember my past life, I was born in that family, they were my parents, etc. So, is that a freak? Is that a lie? Well, in the same Life Divine chapter, it tells us no, it's not a lie necessarily. These are certain instances when there is a rebirth, not immediately, but very shortly after the past birth. So those impressions in the subtle physical mind and the subtle vital, they remain. That means the soul did not really go back into its Ananda Loka or its world of rest. It took birth immediately. And in those instances, there's a possibility of the memory coming back. But that doesn't last long. You have seen all the children, once they have said that, after a while they forget. Because then the soul carries on with its new life and it almost consciously erases them. So here it says, The only memory is the psychic memory, awakening which will overcome the limits of the physical and resuscitate the impressions. So if we can awaken the psychic memory, well, how will you awaken the psychic memory? By realizing the psychic. So if you want to have the memory of your past lives, the only and the best way is to realize the psychic being. So those who have realized their psychic being will, if needed, get glimpses of their past lives or even the details. But as perhaps mother would tell us, at that level you are not interested in your past at all. It may be you might have been a big king or a queen or this or that, because the psychic being looks so much to the future divinity that it has no interest in trying to find out who I was and all that. Well, if necessary, it can tell you. If somebody says, what were you? Then it can recollect and get back. But otherwise, it's not interested or curious, just as our minds, human minds, would be curious now. I doubt whether, even if you could have evidence of the physical memory of past lives, or of such a psychical awakening, the theory would be considered any better proved than before. We now hear of many such instances confidently alleged, though without that apparatus of verified evidence responsibly examined, which gives weight to the results of psychical research. The skeptic can always challenge them as mere fiction and imagination, unless and until they are placed on a firm basis of evidence. So obviously the question of the skeptic always is there, that they want proof, they will not take anything for granted. So it says yes, this question of rebirth is always questionable by a skeptic. So it says, even if the facts alleged were verified, here the resource of affirming that they are not really memories but were known to the person alleging them by ordinary physical means or were suggested to him by others and have been converted into reincarnate memory either by conscious deception or by a process of self-deception and self-hallucination. So in the question of these young children who have memories of their past life, skeptics could come and say, no, all this is humbug. The child has been trained by their parents to tell that, you know, when somebody says, you must tell, I was born there, this is a kind of a conscious self-deception. Or sometimes you tell the child so often that he starts believing, yes, I was really born there. So the skeptic would say, even those instances of reincarnation could be humbug, could be something deceptive, and we should not believe them. And even supposing the evidences were too strong and unexceptionable to be got rid of by these familiar devices, they might yet not be accepted as proof of rebirth. The mind can discover 100 theoretical explanations for a single group of facts. Modern speculation and research have brought in this doubt to overhang all psychical theory and generalization. So Sri Aurobindo is concluding that unfortunately modern speculation can never ever accept, even when they are given concrete proof, they would always bring some other excuse, some other argument to say this is not true. So he says, unfortunately we cannot convince the modern speculation or the scientific mind. We know, for instance, that in the phenomena, say, of automatic writing or of communication from the dead, it is disputed whether the phenomena proceed from outside, from disembodied minds, or from within, from the subliminal consciousness, or whether the communication is actual and immediate from the released personality, or is the uprising to the surface of a telepathic impression which came from the mind of the then living man, but has remained submerged in our subliminal mentality. Well, he gives us another example. In the previous paragraph, we have seen the example of reincarnation. Which also cannot really impress upon the modern mind or the scientific mind. But what about the cases of automatic writing? I think in our previous classes we have seen how this, how Sri Aurobindo himself did this automatic writing. And then it tells us we can call upon these beings. In fact, most often it is their vital being of the deceased who has really come back, who is really called, and he helps in your automatic writing. But now even this incident will not be able to convince the modern man or the scientific man or the modern, what you call, speculation. Why? He says, no, all this could be wrong because it could be a communication which is from the immediately released personality or is uprising to the surface of a telepathic impression or something subliminal. You see, these people argue, no, the person who is helping you is nothing but your own kind of a subliminal impression. You have created this person out of your own desire, your own imagination, and it is that person who is apparently helping you. There could be other arguments telling us that it is our telepathic impression which came from the mind of the then living man. You know, they can have 100 different excuses to really denounce this practice of automatic writing. So they say it is a telepathic impression. That means the person who is dead, his mind has left behind some information, and it is those thoughts which come back to you and help you in your automatic writing. So why is it that if you call Vivekananda, that he would write a particular thing? If you call, say, some XYZ who has never studied in the school, he will write completely different. Because the person who was uneducated, his telepathic and mental impressions are different from an educated man. So they say, it depends whom you are calling. So you see, these are all different arguments that Sri Aurobindo is putting forward. The same kind of doubts might be opposed to the evidences of reincarnate memory. It might be maintained that they prove the power of a certain mysterious faculty in us, a consciousness that can have some inexplicable knowledge of past events. But that these events belong to other personalities than ours, and that our attribution of them to our own personality in past lives is an imagination, a hallucination, or else an instance of that self-appropriation of things and experiences perceived, but not our own, which is one out of the undoubted phenomena of mental error. Much would be proved by an accumulation of such evidences, but not to the skeptic, at least, rebirth. Well, of course, this is the same argument how the skeptic will never ever believe in rebirth, because he can never believe in this question of a mysterious faculty. I mean, as you said, you know, anything beyond the physical is not acceptable to the scientist. So he cannot believe that there is a mysterious faculty in man, that there is something else in man which can take a rebirth, something else in man which has a different memory. All these things they cannot believe, because as it says, it might be maintained that they prove the power of a certain mysterious faculty in us, a consciousness that can have some inexplicable knowledge, but these events belong to other personalities than ours, and then attribute them to our own personality in past lives as an imagination, a hallucination, an instance of self-appropriation. So these are the same arguments. You may talk to them about the childhood reincarnation memory, you may talk to them about this automatic writing, but all the time they would say, all this is hallucination, imagination, self-appropriation. So ultimately what Sri Aurobindo wants to tell us is, on a rational, scientific basis, it becomes almost impossible to convince anyone of the process and the problem of rebirth. So certainly if there was sufficiently ample, exact, profuse, intimate, they would create an atmosphere which would lead in the end to a general acceptance of the theory by the human race as a moral certitude. But proof is a different matter. Even if there are a large number of studies done in this case, it could create an atmosphere. People may in the long run say, all right, it could be considered. Some psychologist may take this into his consideration, but he says it's difficult to convince the rationalist. After all, most of the things that we accept as truths are really no more than moral certitudes. We have all the profoundest, unshakable faith that the earth revolves on its own axis. But as has been pointed out by a great French mathematician, the fact has never been proved. It is only a theory which accounts well for certain observable facts, no more. Who knows whether it may not be replaced in this or another century by a better or a worse? You see, when it comes to the question of believing, leave alone the question of rebirth, you may need proof. He says, what is the proof that the earth is rotating on an axis? We have all taken it for granted that the earth rotates on its own axis. It is slightly tilted and it goes round. Okay, it is verifiable by certain observable facts, like the night and day. So these are some of the proofs they say, how we can find out the earth rotating, the exact number of hours that it takes for night and the day, etc. But it says, who knows? In the next century, some other scientists will say, no, earth is not rotating on its axis, there's something else that's happening. So until that happens, we have taken this for granted. So it says, similarly, rebirth also has to be taken. We cannot have solid physical proof, but it is all of our belief, be it scientific, practical, material, these are all our beliefs. For example, the simplest thing which he talked in the Life Divine, in one of the earliest chapters, he says, we all believe the sun is rising. We all go to the seashore and say, hey, we want to see the sunrise. But if the sun rises, but it's we have built our entire day on the sunrise and sunset. Isn't that a false thing? But we believe. And it's a practical thing for us to say, sunrise, sunset, you get up in the morning, you do Surya Namaskar to the sunrise, but where is the sunrise? It never rises. So he says, everything in our life, from the most normal, usual, day-to-day affair of a sunrise to rebirth, they're all our beliefs, and nothing has really that so-called concrete proof to refute. Even though this scientist tells us, it's not the sun rising, it's just the rotation of the earth, who would believe that? So similarly, if you tell the scientist, it is not a reincarnation, it's a rebirth of a psychic being, they will not rebirth. But that doesn't mean that we give up our own belief. Just because somebody said it's the earth which is rotating, nobody stops saying sunrise. I mean, people have written great poems. What is that ancient mariner? I remember always that line from my childhood. Who wrote that ancient mariner? Who is the poet? Coleridge. Not dim nor red, like God's own head, the glorious sun upraised. Inspiring. Not dim, not red, he was seeing the sunrise,
nor dim nor red, like God's own head, the glorious sun uprest. But if you tell that fellow you are doing a stupid thing, there is no sunrise, what happens? All poetry is lost. So, what Sri Aurobindo is telling us, you see, this is not arguing only against rebirth, it can be argued with almost everything that we do in our normal life. Who knows whether it may not be replaced in this or another century by a better or a worse. All observed astronomical phenomena were admirably accounted for by theories of spheres, and I know not what else before Galileo came in with his "and yet it moves," disturbing the infallibility of popes and Bibles and the science and logic of the learned. One feels certain that admirable theories could be invented to account for the facts of gravitation if our intellects were not prejudiced and prepossessed by the anterior demonstration of Newton. Well, there's a footnote there. This was written before the theory of Einstein came to be known. This is the ever-perplexing and inherent plague of our reason, for it starts by knowing nothing and has to deal with infinite possibilities and the possible explanation of any given set of facts until we actually know what is behind them are endless. Well, of course, this is what we have just discussed about Galileo coming and telling us, you know, the question of Earth is round and it moves and all that. You know, when science discovered that that the Earth is round, and the question of and also the theory of the gravitation theory, etc. You see, it must have shocked those religious popes who believed in the Bible, where there's no question of Earth rotating or there's the question of sun rotating, nothing. It was God had created the Earth, and then Earth was supervised by the same God. But all this process of creation, that first there was only matter and then life came, etc. He says it must have shocked them, because they cannot believe that there could be new chapters of knowledge added. So that's exactly what, I mean, all this Sri Aurobindo is arguing only to tell us how this question of rebirth is also so very difficult, because we can keep on arguing against it endlessly, but he says we can find the truth on a different level. So this is the ever-perplexing inherent plague of our reason. In the end, we really know only what we observe. And even that subject to a haunting question. For instance, that green is green and white is white, although it appears that color is not color but something else that creates the appearances of color. You see, really he has given us such simple examples that we say something is green, something is red, something is blue. But is there anything called green and blue? Scientifically, there is nothing called green and blue. It is all a question of the vibrations. There is a kind of a difference in the vibrations and the colors are perceived. But I think there is nothing called a color that is fixedly green, because it's a matter of the vibrations which are hitting our eyes, and then our eyes respond, they get accustomed, and then they say this is green. For example, in our childhood, when we are shown a book and say, "Beta, this is green." So that this is green, and the green color, that the vibration that the eye has caught, have been fixed in his mind. And the next time he has the same vibration, he says, "Oh, that is green." But otherwise, neutrally, there is nothing called color. White is white and red is red, nothing like that. Beyond observable fact, we must be content with reasonable logical satisfaction, dominating probability and moral certitude, at least until we have the sense to observe that there are faculties in us higher than the sense-dependent reason, and awaiting development by which we can arrive at greater certainties. So it's a very simple practical thing.
that we must wait and find out that there are other faculties than your sense-dependent reason. Because he has given us enough examples that even your sense-dependent reason, talking about color goes wrong, or talking about sunrise goes wrong, or talking about the earth's rotation, it goes wrong. So, how do we see all this? We have to come to understand that there are other faculties beyond the sense-dependent reason. So, all fruits cannot be brought down to the level of the sense-dependent reason and the intellect. It's only by going to the next level of faculties we can have higher knowledge. We cannot really assert as against the skeptic any such dominant probability or any such certitude on behalf of the theory of rebirth. The external evidence yet available is in the last degree rudimentary. Pythagoras was one of the greatest of sages, but his assertion that he fought at Troy under the name of Antenorid and was slain by the younger son of Atreus is an assertion only, and his identification of the Trojan shield will convince no one who is not already convinced. The modern evidence is not as yet any more convincing than the proof of Pythagoras. You see, Sri Aurobindo is giving us very simple common arguments to tell us, you see, Pythagoras, one of the greatest sages of the ancient times, if he says, you know, I fought in the Trojan War, I was so and so, he said, most of the people may deny it. They say, no, what's the proof? So, or some people who believe that yes, he was a sage who has fought like that, they will continue to believe. So, what it means is, those who tend to believe, if you tell them something, they will act with their belief that there is rebirth, etc. But those who tend not to believe, you cannot really convince them on the rational level. Well, elsewhere also he would say, reason ultimately cannot prove, cannot convince anybody. If somebody stubbornly says, no, I'm sorry, I don't believe, then no amount of arguments can make him believe. So similarly saying, those who want to believe will believe. In the absence of external proof which to our matter-governed sensational intellects is alone conclusive, we have the argument of the reincarnationists that their theory accounts for all the facts better than any other yet advanced. The claim is just, but it does not create any kind of certitude. So this is the same argument that because we, what beautifully Sri Aurobindo calls it, matter-governed sensational intellects, the scientific mind or the rational mind is matter-governed sensational intellect. That means these minds which want only sensational material proof, he says you cannot really give them anything that is convincing. So it cannot be convincing. The theory of rebirth coupled with that of karma gives us a simple, symmetrical, beautiful explanation of things. But so too the theory of spheres gave us once a simple, symmetrical, beautiful explanation of the heavenly movements. Yet we have now got quite another explanation, much more complex, much more gothic and shaky in its symmetry, an inexplicable order evolved out of chaotic infinities, which we accept as the truth of the matter. And yet, if we will only think, we shall perhaps see that even this is not the whole truth. There is much more behind we have not yet discovered. Therefore, the simplicity, symmetry, beauty, satisfactoriness of the reincarnation theory is no warrant of its certitude. Well, this entire portion, as you can see, has been almost an introduction, because from the next para that he is going to take up the theory of rebirth. But he had to clear up the grounds as if to tell us that no amount of this theories of reincarnation, which kind of, you know, gives a very beautiful, symmetrical, believable explanation of why we are born, why do we come upon earth, for what purpose, then giving the whole of our life a kind of a meaning. All this we can believe because we really find that without rebirth, life is meaningless. But then he would tell us that not so for the scientist, because he has also believed previously on the theory of spheres. Well, that was the theory before Galileo told us about the truth of the planets, how the sun moves and the earth moves around the sun, etc. So he says every time science has given us a beautiful theory, but then it was discarded by another theory. So he's telling us, even if we give to the world a beautiful theory of rebirth, which really includes all existence, individual, cosmic, transcendent, etc., he says, do not be sure if the scientists would really take you for granted. So in one word, in one brief sentence, that we have to leave this argument and not try to convince those non-believers. So Sri Aurobindo is not trying to really say, oh, you scientists, you must believe in this theory because I am going to explain. He says, no, scientists' mind have changed so many times their theories that even this theory may not be accepted so for certitude. So after giving us this explanation, now he is going to give us a little more into different arguments for the question of rebirth. But always keep this in mind that don't you ever enter into a debate, go to a seminar and say, you know, this is rebirth, you must all believe because Sri Aurobindo has said and I'm trying to give some magic points. Just forget about it. So any conference on rebirth, I think we should not attempt. You can see he's himself warning us, it won't help any non-believer.